It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
We got so much to pack in today. I'm just not even going to start with the niceties. That I
Probably a good idea.
All right. Starting with the Parks Department. Sounds like there's going to be some fireworks there.
In more ways than one, yes. That's very cute. Residents in Laurelhurst discovered this week that next week, on Friday, the Windermere Realty and UW, as part of the opening of boating season, are going to have a fireworks display on Union Bay, shot off of a barge out in the bay. And that sounds all well and good. They did a similar thing on a smaller scale last year. But what happened last year is that some of the residents in the area and various other environmentalists were concerned about a patch of land that, for anybody who's familiar with the area, lies between the UW athletic fields on the one side and the Center for Urban Horticulture on the other, and abuts Union Bay. It's a very environmentally sensitive wetlands. A lot of endangered species are there. There's a lot of restoration work going on that's being done by the Center for Urban Horticulture. It's a very environmentally sensitive area. And this, for the birds that are there, including some eagle nesting, this happens to be the height of nesting season. Well, last year, the residents went to the Parks Department and said, you know, you really shouldn't have done this. You shouldn't have had people tromping through the area. You shouldn't have had the noise and the debris and the pollution that comes from the fireworks, certainly without doing any kind of environmental review. And Virginia Swanson, the Parks Department employee who heads the special events committee that issues permits for this sort of thing, said, gee, we had no idea about that. If we'd known that, we would have never issued the permit. This won't happen again. We won't allow it to happen again. And if the proposal comes up, we'll certainly notify all of you. Well, imagine the surprise of the same critics when they heard on the mountain this week, the radio station that is simulcasting the fireworks display and promoting it heavily on their station and encouraging people to come on down and take a look, that they were doing it all over again. And then, in fact, the Parks Department, it's actually City of Seattle land, but for some arcane reason, the Parks Department has jurisdiction over it, that the Parks Department had, and the Special Events Committee, had approved a permit for the fireworks on April 12th without notifying any of the people who were concerned last year or seemingly anybody else in the public, and without taking any of the environmental concerns into question, even though Virginia Swanson, the chair, was told about them last year and, you know, had it in writing. So these people have been hitting the roof and, emailing city council and calling various agencies, and the Audubon Society has gotten involved. The Center for Urban Horticulture, which maintains the restoration work on the land, found out about it when the neighbors called and told them. They had no idea this was going on. So a lot of people are upset about it. The fireworks are scheduled for next Friday night. And Thursday night, I was at a regularly scheduled Parks Board meeting where some people tromped on down and testified, and in the hallway confronted embattled Park Superintendent Ken Bounds about this. Now, Bounds, as you may remember, and the Parks Department in general, have had a lot of heat in recent months from various neighborhood groups at Gasworks Park with the One Real Summer Concert Series, with the skate park at Woodland Park, with the proposed parking garage at Woodland Park Zoo, the cutting down trees, Occidental Park, etc. There's been a lot of top-down decision-making in the Parks Department that doesn't involve the public, and a lot of it has involved the use of parks land for commercial interests, both of which apply here. So they buttonholed Ken Bounds in the hallway and got him to agree to ask Virginia Swanson to reconvene the special events committee this week, this coming week, and revisit the question of whether the permit should be issued for the fireworks display. Now, it's very late in the game. It's probably unlikely that they will do it, just because they're going to meet on Tuesday, which is only 3 days before the fireworks is scheduled. But there are a lot of really compelling environmental reasons why this should never have been approved in the first place and why it shouldn't take place. The Parks Department, in their generosity, has scheduled the hearing in the morning when people who work are going to have a very hard time attending. So residents of Laurelhurst, Audubon Society, and other groups like that are encouraging people to come down to make your presence known and to let folks know that this is environmentally inappropriate. It's 10 o'clock until noon on Tuesday morning at the Parks Department headquarters, the boardroom, right across from KEXP, actually, on 100 Dexter Avenue North, just north of Denny Way. So come on down, and we'll repeat that again at the calendar at the end of the show.
And my understanding is the concern here isn't so much about the fireworks themselves, it's about the people that that is drawing into that area. Is that
well,
correct?
It's both. The mountain is asking folks to assemble at the baseball field, which is adjacent, and the free parking in the area is all in Laurelhurst, where, you know, near the Center for Urban Horticulture, where people will just walk through the wetlands to get there. So that's a concern, but the noise certainly affects animals that live in the wetlands area. The debris and the pollution that's caused by the fireworks certainly can affect them also. And again, particularly for the birds, for nesting season, it's an extremely sensitive time of year where anything could literally be life and death for some of these animals. So it's just really bad timing.
All right. Moving along, there was a sit-in this week in Maria Cantwell's office.
Yes, and you probably didn't hear anything about it unless you maybe read the Stranger's blog or the new Eat the State that's come out. I think KUOW had something on it on Tuesday when seven activists went into Maria Cantwell's office at noon and said that they weren't going to leave until Maria Cantwell changed her position on the war, basically. They had about 90 minutes on the phone with a senior aide in Washington, D.C., who gave the usual apologetics. And then 5:30 came when the building normally closed and they expected to get arrested. And Cantwell's staff was so sensitive about the possibility of publicity around this, and obviously they did a pretty good job of suppressing the publicity since it wasn't covered by the dailies, wasn't covered by any TV stations, et cetera, that they kept the office open all night. Two of Cantwell's staffers stayed all night so that the there was one woman in the group and she decided to bow out at 5:30 because she didn't want to be the only woman who's arrested and separated out and sent to jail. But the six people that were remaining, including the father of the local father of a or a soldier who was killed in Iraq, several other people who were involved in military families, Rich Gamble, pastor of a local church, Howard Gale, who's been involved in a lot of anti-war organizing. I mean, you know, people that are fairly prominent in the anti-war movement in this area. Six folks stayed. They stayed all night. They stayed into the following day. And at 1 o'clock on Wednesday, they suspended the sit-in when they got an agreement from Cantwell to meet with them when she's back in town during a congressional recess on May 6th. What they're saying is if the results of that meeting are not satisfactory, they reserve the right to start the sit-in all over again. And, you know, if they do, maybe they'll have some other folks joining them this time because hopefully we can publicize it a little farther. But this is one of a number of sit-ins that have occurred around the country against mostly Democratic senators who have either supported the war or have been urged to do more to oppose the war. There was one last month where 19 people were arrested in Ron Wyden's Portland office. So this is something that's happening around the country, and hopefully we can see more of it here because we definitely need to see more pressure, particularly put on Maria Cantwell around her support of the war.
All right. And Cantwell this week filed a complaint?
Yeah, actually, it was the Democratic Party that did on behalf of Cantwell against Mike McGavick, her Republican opponent, probably in the general election. McGavick, of course, is the former CEO of Safeco and an insurance industry lobbyist. When he decided to resign his position at Safeco in order to run for the Senate, Safeco provided him with a very, very nice golden parachute. Now, it turns out not only did they do that, but they kept him on the payroll until after January 1st as a quote-unquote consultant, and by doing so gave him an additional $13 million worth of stock options. There's a total of $17 million that they've given McGavick after he announced for Senate. And what the Democrats are alleging is that this basically is a backdoor campaign contribution, money that Gavick can then turn around and pour into his Senate campaign, and he's already put a fair amount of his own money into the campaign. It'll be very, very interesting to see how the FEC handles this complaint. It's a fairly major complaint, and one that I think is, you know, pretty justified, because clearly Safeco is, what they're doing is making an awful lot of money available to McGavick at the exact same time that he also coincidentally needs an awful lot of money to run for the U.S. Senate.
All right. And moving along, speaking of pouring money, this week the city council moved along the idea of the Sonics getting a new stadium.
Yeah, a subcommittee voted to recommend that the council send a resolution to the mayor encouraging the mayor to negotiate with the Sonics for the use of public money to construct a new arena where Key Arena now is, and in Seattle Center. That will go to a full vote of the city council on Monday. So people who care about this, call or write your city council people, or better yet, show up on Monday. Incidentally, there's a protest that was announced yesterday that will happen on May the 11th, a Thursday at noon at City Hall. It will be a going away party for the Sonics, tentatively entitled Find Them, Leave. There will be more information on this coming out and around, but there will be a planning meeting for that next Tuesday, which I'll talk about when we get to events at the end of the half hour.
All right. Well, moving to national, there is a big national event coming up on Monday.
Many big national events, actually, but it's all part of a coordinated day of action for comprehensive immigration reform. The immigrants will be striking and marching and rallying once again. Probably almost certainly the biggest event so far. The organizers in Los Angeles, for example, are expecting 2 to 3 million people in Los Angeles alone. And this will actually be the first day that these marches have occurred simultaneously all across the country. In the past, there have been a number on the same day, but not in every city where these marches have been held. On Monday, May Day, that will be the case. May Day, of course, for folks who have forgotten, started in 1886 in Chicago as International Workers' Day. And, you know, not only is it a day for workers, but in Chicago in 1886, most of the workers and the families were foreign immigrants, particularly German immigrants. The Haymarket bombing that sent eight anarchists got death sentences off of. I think five of those anarchists were actually German immigrants. So, it hasn't changed that much since 1886. Then as now, corporations were trying to exploit cheap immigrant labor. A lot of English-speaking Americans were distrusted and feared the immigrant part of the labor force that didn't even speak English. And finally, in 1886, the immigrants had enough and stood up and started striking and marching. And that's exactly what's happened in 2006 and what's going to happen on Monday. Here in Seattle, folks will gather at 3:30 at 20th and Jackson. You're asked to wear black, and there will be a silent march to the federal building. And I'll repeat that also at the end of the half hour.
All right. Karl Rove getting some special attention this week.
Yes. Jason Leopold of Truth Out, who I've quoted on this show before, was reporting yesterday that Patrick Fitzgerald, now that he's coming off of his successful conviction of Illinois Governor George Ryan on corruption charges, is turning his full attention to the Valerie Plame Wilson case. And he is asking a grand jury this week to consider indicting Rove. He wants to do it on charges of perjury, on charges of lying to investigators in 2003. The perjury was to a grand jury in 2004, and a possibility also of obstruction of justice, depending on what Rove said when he was called to testify before the grand jury again this past Wednesday. So look for that. If the grand jury decides to go along with it, there will be an announcement probably on Friday. And that could obviously throw a big monkey wrench into the Republicans' plans to have Rove mastermind their attempt to hang on to the control of the Senate and the House in 2006. So it could be a very, very big deal, not just for the indictment of Rove, but for what it means for Republicans' election chances in 2006. Meantime, very interestingly, there's another case going on in which two AIPAC lobbyists, that's right, there is an Israeli lobby, even though you may have read that there's not, are accused of trying to obtain classified information. And the lawyers for those said this week that the source of the classified information for the lobbyists that are now being charged with trying to obtain it were several senior administration officials, including none other than Condoleezza Rice. So in addition to President Bush having been outed as leaking classified information, it looks like Condoleezza Rice now is also being outed for the same thing. And leaking it, in this case, to a sympathetic pro-Israel lobby. So keep an eye on this one as well.
All right, moving along. John Conyers is looking at suing.
Not looking at doing. He's done it. Ten congressional Democrats, led by John Conyers, are suing over the little stunt that's been pulled by President Bush, where in a budget bill that was passed in February had a late amendment added to it that included some additional money for an entitlement, and Bush decided he didn't like that provision. So what did he do? He signed an earlier version of the bill. In other words, he signed a version that had never been passed by the House of Representatives. This is, you know, somewhat unconstitutional, and Conyers and his colleagues are suing in order to get that presidential signature rescinded, because Bush does not have the right under the Constitution to sign into law legislation that has not been passed in identical fashion by both houses. So again, keep an eye on this one, and it's yet another example of Bush making up the Constitution as he goes along. It's a very, very worrisome attitude on behalf of the White House.
All right. And I understand that Donald Rumsfeld is also being sued.
Yes, he is. He's being sued by six New York teenagers. And what they are suing him over, and the reason that those teenagers have standing, is that the Pentagon has, and this was announced late last year, or I don't think announced so much as reported, and the Pentagon verified it, that the Pentagon has been compiling a base of 12 million youth, age 16 and over, who are considered potential recruits for the military. And so the military has created this database that includes things like grades, results of aptitude tests, hobbies, interests, gender, race, ethnicity, etc. And some of the things that are compiled in that database, number one, they need to be erased after a period of time, and the Pentagon has not done that. But number two, even compiling some of the categories of information is illegal. And so the teenagers are suing, saying, look, this database shouldn't exist. It's an invasion of privacy, and it's illegal under federal statutes. And, you know, we'll see where that goes, too.
Yeah, my understanding is for citizens in general here in the U.S. have approximately 850-some pieces of data collected on them in various databases around the country that are accessible to corporations.
Yeah, and if you know where to look, it's not just accessible to corporations. It's accessible to anybody who can get on the internet and look in the proper places. Privacy in this country has really become an illusion.
Moving along, you mentioned the Pentagon. The Pentagon is looking at letting some detainees go?
Yeah, there's about 500 prisoners remaining in Guantanamo Bay, and the Pentagon announced this week that it's going to release one-third of them. It didn't say when it was going to release them. They've already been held, in most cases, for four or more years, and the Pentagon announced basically that these guys were innocent, that they posed no security threat to the United States so far as they could tell. Well, there's two questions here. One is why they were held so long in the first place, when many of these cases, it has been pretty obvious that they were picked up by mistake, or just happened to be in the wrong place at the wrong time, or somebody who didn't like them sold their name to Pakistani intelligence and it went from there, etc. The second question is, why can't they be released right now? Why are they continuing to be held in isolation, to be abused, in some cases to be tortured, at Guantanamo Bay, and we've learned all this from people who have been released in the past, why? And who suffered through that, even though they were innocent, why are these people continuing to be held? It's good news that they're going to be released, presumably, eventually, but it begs the question of why they can't get out now.
Right.
What happens to the remaining two-thirds of people who are in legal limbo and who are still being held under unmentionable conditions?
Jumping to international, Mexico is looking at some decriminalization.
Yes. The Mexican legislature passed on Friday, and Vicente Fox, who is the outgoing president, is expected to sign legislation that basically decriminalizes possession of a wide variety of drugs, not just marijuana, but cocaine, heroin, amphetamines, opium, you know, all sorts of drugs that are being decriminalized in small amounts. And it specifies the amounts that are being decriminalized that you can have possession of. And in some cases, you know, they're fairly large personal use type of amounts. Now, buying and selling these drugs is still illegal. And the same legislation actually toughens laws for trafficking in larger amounts. But this is a piece of legislation that has truly alarmed the United States. And what they're afraid of course, is that in the same way that people go down to Tijuana to buy medications over the counter that are not available that way in the United States, that they're also going to go down to Tijuana and buy stuff that they can self-medicate with. Why people should be alarmed about the free market at its finest, I don't quite understand. But, good for Mexico, and we'll see what happens to this because, of course, Mexico is a primary recipient of U.S. quote-unquote assistance in terms of prosecution of the war on drugs. So there's going to be some friction over this, I would almost guarantee it.
All right. And jumping all the way over to Iraq. Any developments this week?
Oh, lots of developments this week in Iraq. We found out more about the new prime minister that was named literally as we were going on the air last Saturday. Where did it go here? I haven't memorized it yet. Jawad al-Maliki. He is a hardline Shiite. He's just as hardline, if not more so, than al-Jafari, who's the guy that was basically forced out by pressure from the United States. He is basically a thug, and he has been very, very careful to advocate in all cases for more Shiite power and not for a centralized national government of unity. More interestingly still, this supposed national unity government that the United States forced the Shiites to adapt didn't include any of the secular parties, didn't include Allied Alawi, any of those different parties. What they did is they made common cause with the radical clerics of the Sunnis and formed a government that way, and the same with the Kurds. So there is nobody in the national unity government among the various political parties involved that, number one, believes in a secular Iraq, number two, believes in a nationalist Iraq. All of these different parties want power devolved to the various provinces and constituencies. So it's not a national unity government. It's a government that's going to push very hard for the Shiites to have autonomy in the south, for the Kurds to have autonomy in the north, and for the Sunnis to be left holding the bag. It's also, in this case, al-Maliki does not believe at all, unlike his predecessor, in negotiating with the insurgency. So the opportunity for a political settlement of what has really become a civil war in Iraq seems to be much farther away than it was before the United States pushed for this government of national unity on the theory that it would prevent civil war. So once again, Washington seems to have screwed up and just made the situation in Iraq worse. That shouldn't really come as any surprise at this point. There were a number of other things that came out this week. The Washington Post revealed that six more U.S. inspections of Interior Ministry jails since we discovered that 173 people were being tortured and abused at a Interior Ministry jail in November. Six more jails have been inspected since then by the U.S. military, and in almost all of them, there has been evidence of continuing prisoner abuse, continuing torture. It looks like this is an ongoing problem, despite all of the U.S. diplomatic pressure to try and get it resolved, and will continue to be a problem as long as hardline Shiites and their militia continue to be in control of the Interior Ministry, continue to be in control of the National Police. That's where the death squad activity is coming from, and that's a fair part of the reason why things are descending into civil war in Iraq. We have also this week a report in the New York Times that on Tuesday that, and I'll just say this as a direct quote, that troubled decision-making and execution was just as responsible as security concerns for the complete failure of reconstruction efforts in Iraq. In other words, there was a lot of waste. There were a lot of poor decisions. There was a lot of money that shouldn't have been spent that was on projects that were doomed from the beginning because of engineering problems. There's a lot of room for investigation of what American companies and the American government did to screw up reconstruction. It wasn't just a function of the fact that it was unsafe because of the insurgency, and that's kind of a major development. Well, 60 Minutes had a program Sunday night, which, like the New York Times report on NSA spying, a significant part of the 60 Minutes report had actually been scheduled to air before the 2004 elections, and it was a comprehensive overview of the evidence that the Bush administration not only lied, but as we now know, basically used a systematic campaign of lies and disinformation and scare tactics in order to stampede the country into war. The thing that was new that wasn't available in 2004 but that was aired last Sunday night is a top-ranking CIA analyst or former CIA analyst, a guy named Tyler Drumheller, who says that, among other things, the United States had flipped and the CIA actually had on its payroll and was talking to the foreign minister of Saddam Hussein's government before the invasion. So they had access to the inner circle of Saddam Hussein and everything they were talking about and everything they were deciding. Unfortunately, the White House dropped this guy as a source, as a hot potato, when he informed the Americans that the weapons of mass destruction that they were basing a war effort on actually had not existed since the early 1990s, that Iraq had destroyed them, which turned out to be true. So they got this directly from the Iraqi foreign minister in Saddam's inner circle, who they had on their payroll as a source, and they not only didn't believe him, but discounted him as a source because he gave them that information. And when the CIA objected, what they were told was, this isn't a matter of intelligence, this is a matter of policy, and regime change is going to go on regardless. So they had all this information that WMD did not exist, and they convinced the American public otherwise.
All right. Unfortunately, we don't have time for any more international. How about events that are coming up this week?
Okay. There's a lot going on in Iran, so I'll just post that information on the ETS blog, which I'll get to in a minute. Lots of events going on this coming week. In a few minutes at 9 a.m., the big anti-war march in New York City is scheduled to step off. Sunday night, as you heard during the 7:30 hour, as part of his several appearances this weekend, David Barsamian is doing a benefit for Eat the State. It'll be at 6:30, talking about media, imperialism, and propaganda. It will be at University Baptist Church, 47th and 12th Northeast. I think they gave out the wrong location at 7:30.
I gave out the wrong.
Okay. But anyway, 47th and 12th Northeast in the University District, 6:30, $5 to $15 suggested donation. Be there. It'll be a lot of fun. Incidentally, Eat the State will also have a music benefit with artists The Spoon Man and some other acts on May 9th at Tractor Tavern, so I'll get to that next week. And it's also in the current ETS issue. Monday, as I mentioned, there's the Immigrant March that will kick off at 3:30 from Judkins Park near 20th and Jackson. Wear black, and it'll be a silent march to the Federal Building for a rally there, probably around 5 o'clock. On Tuesday, 10 a.m. to noon, as I mentioned, the Special Events Committee at the Parks Department headquarters will be considering rescinding the permit for the fireworks at Union Bay and the environmentally sensitive wetlands that are adjacent. 10 to noon, 100 North Dexter, Dexter and Denny Way, across the street from KEXP. Tuesday evening, there will be a planning meeting at the Elysian Pub in Capitol Hill, 1221 East Pike, for the Sonics rally on May 11th. Actually, the Sonics going away party, the Find Now Leave event. So that'll be at 7 p.m. at the Elysian Pub on Tuesday night. And then Friday night, Roy Bourgeois will be in town at University Friends meeting as part of a kickoff for an all-day event on Saturday of workshops on ways we resist as part of the National War Tax Resistance Committee National meetings that are going to be held in Seattle next weekend.
All right. Talking with John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State, and just the website and the contact phone number, please.
Okay. And the calendar information is all available on the website, too, or most of it should be, or on the blog, and I'll make sure that it gets up there. Eat the State comes out every couple weeks. Current issue is out. Back issue is also available, www.eatthestate.org. If you have any questions or comments, tips, feedbacks, want to volunteer for our benefits, want to find out about our benefits because you missed them, give us a call. The number is area code 206-719-6947.